You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
It gives me such a great pleasure to have Philippe here. It's not the first time he's presented here, and every single time it's insightful again. I think it's over a decade since I first met you, and I just remember you were then still doing work in the European Commission.
That's correct.
And it was sort of, man, this guy understands things. I wish all government and civil servants had that kind of insight. It turns out they don't, not even in the EC, and that Philippe is really unique and was there in understanding the importance of free and open source software before many, many others, and was there for fights on software patents in Europe. And when people started talking about e-governance and participation in democracy, he ended up building the systems that actually ran genuine online participation platforms in various municipalities. And he's speaking to, so every time it's listening to Philippe is listening to about a few years ahead into the distance, which is a fantastic treat. And so today he'll be talking to us about his new book that's coming out, published in middle of November, and treats a problem that has vexed many of us here for a while, which in some senses is how we convert from, isn't it fantastic that we all have the free capacity to be creative, to how do we build sustainable models for making a living to some extent from some of what we do creatively, and in particular, obviously, this has been vexing in the music industry and for artists. Thank you so much for coming and
thank you
speaking
for
to us.
Kind words. Thanks a lot for being so many here, and despite a slightly cryptic title of my talk, I mean, basically, we, as Yochai said, we are going to discuss the condition for the sustainability of activities that lead to works that could be shared on the internet. It's after Yochai, two kind introduction, you're bound for disappointment, but nonetheless, I'm going to ask you to do a small thought experiment, and if you refuse, I will be in trouble. But if you accept, then we will have three rounds of discussion, quick rounds, on a question that I will briefly introduce. Let's say, another point, as Catalina, for instance, has already noticed, I'm slightly deaf. So when you will express yourself in the discussion, if you want me to understand, it's better if you speak a bit loud. So you all know that about a few billions, exactly how many billions, depends on how you're counting, but a few billions people are equipped with a mean to copy information and to send it, exchange it with other people, and that allows them to share works of culture or works of public expression. So this is really the world I'm looking at, but it's not just works that are shareable because their authors have decided to authorize that. It's all digital works that have been made available to the public, whatever, in whatever form, commercial or not, but in digital form. By sharing, I mean posting on a site, sending, putting on a peer-to-peer network, swapping USB keys, really whatever ways there are to exchange or provide copies of a work to another individual or to many other individuals. Now let's imagine that this very basic capability is recognized. I wrote in my notes recognized as a fundamental right, but actually maybe it's not, that is not even necessary. It can be just also recognized as beyond the scope of the copyright arm. But you just can recognize that copyright has nothing to say with what people do with digital works in the non-commercial or non-market sphere. So we are no longer concerned with compensating the entertainment industry with alleged arms. It's a first from this sharing. We can. I myself did that. There was nothing wrong about trying to find a way to let powerful players stop their war on sharing. But that's not what I'm suggesting now. What I'm suggesting now is let's imagine we have that achieved already, and now we can start addressing issues that are very important. Is what is a reasonable financing system for ensuring the sustainability of the activities that give rise to these works that are shared? And actually, some of them are pretty sustainable without us doing anything. I mean, there are elements of public expression that are that recent examples have shown to be very alive without any specific scheme to make them sustainable. But in many cases, people need additional resources to become better at what they are doing. So my reference situation is not the professional artist trying to make a living of only its professional artist practice, a situation which is extremely rare, actually. But it's rather any person who tries to become better at what he or she is doing to produce digital works. So that's the thought experiment is we have this giant sphere of sharing, and now we ask ourselves, how can we contribute to a model that I have called the many-to-all cultural society? That is the society where very many people produce works that are made accessible to anybody on the internet, and quite a few, many more than ever, deserve the attention of a significant number of people. So you see, I use qualitative words like many, significant number, and I mean, we'll see what that could mean. So I'm going now to move to the three rounds of discussion. By financing models, I mean schemes. I'm not suggesting we are discussing the exact nature of the schemes, but I want to ask you your opinion on a number of key parameters that impact any financial scheme that tries to do what I have just described. The first question is very simple, is what are the beauties and the drawbacks of ex ante support to help people produce new things, and ex post rewards, that is rewards for people having being the producer of works that have been appreciated. Traditionally, the financing of creative and expressive activities have used a combination of both schemes. The typical forms of ex ante support were sponsorship, I mean, in the old sense, mecenas, employment, and public subsidies. Employment in statutes like being a professor at Harvard Law School, where producing works is something expected of you. And public subsidies in many different forms. And the typical form of ex post rewards were revenues from activities of performance, like concerts, but public projection of movies in theaters, or sales of cultural goods. Actually, sales of cultural goods played a smaller role than the revenues from performance, always. But so these financial sources, they are there to stay, but they struggle to cover the needs of a many to old cultural society. And I think the implicit diagnosis in that motivates me to ask the question is that the source of the problems we see everywhere, and the screams and the complaints, is simply that there are many more people that are good at producing digital works than before. That's what really challenges our way to organize the financing of cultural and creative activity. So it becomes reasonable to look for additional schemes. And the additional is very important, because don't think they will replace the existing schemes. They are meant as complement. So the proponents of schemes for activities whose products are freely shared, in the past 10 years, this has been a hot topic for about 10 years, so starting 2002. Most often they have chosen one of the two sides. That is the designer of compensatory schemes. They have almost always focused on rewards based on some proxy of usage or enjoyment or whatever. But they would define some form of measure of usage and distribute rewards. In contrast, the people who were away from compensation, and for example, the Blur Banff proposal of 2002, which is a group of artists and advocacy people met in Banff in Canada, and they designed a scheme for sustainable financing of creativity in the digital era, and they entirely focused on ex ante support. That is, they said we will have competitive intermediaries, and people will choose to distribute, for example, a compulsory statutory payment among these intermediaries that will compete to attract funds like churches in Germany or whatever by posting their policy of support to new activities. In my own work, I have supported a combination of both schemes. By the time, it's a bit unusual. So basically, what I'm asking is really, sincerely, I would like to know your opinion about what are the beauties and the drawbacks of ex ante support and ex post rewards. So the floor is yours, actually. I have some vague ideas on this subject, but I'd like to hear your viewpoint first.
The first thing that comes to my mind is that it doesn't always work to support the artist. After the example I would cite is Radiohead. Do you know this band, this American band?
Yes, I do.
They sold their album online for whatever you wanted to pay for it. And I assume it was a good experiment, but perhaps not a successful one, as they did not try it again. So I wonder if always you can expect the crowd to support something of their own volition, like the donation model you just cited.
The donation model I mentioned, just a precision, it was based on a statutory payment. That is, people would have to pay so much per month in the Blur Banff proposal. But your question remains fully valid, of course, because you have to, if it is not acceptance to pay each time, there is still the acceptance of paying the statutory contribution. Sorry.
So ex post support wouldn't necessarily work well in artistic fields where there's significant costs incurred at the beginning. So, like, let's say you'll want to make a movie and you need to buy, you don't have opportunities to rent equipment, you need to buy a video camera, you need to buy video editing time, that sort of thing. If you don't, if you have to sort of put up all this money in order to just get your product made with no necessarily huge guarantee of results, you may not be able to afford to wait for the subsidies afterwards.
Can we do something a little different from where you were going, since Terry is sitting there and has spent and is one of the targets of your exposed distributing based on usage. But Terry, would it be okay to sort of nudge you to accept or reject this characterization? I know that it's in the middle, it's not fair, but I think it would be, since you opened the conversation.
Yeah, but I didn't have Terry in mind, because Terry was moving very far away from the compensatory model, just didn't do the last step, that, in the sense that it was, he still spoke about compensation, if I'm correct. What do we, but please, I mean, I'm humbled and frightened and honored.
joking aside, I'm sure that's not true. But you and I have been working on these things in parallel for a long time. And I regard the remaining issues as matters of nuance. Important to address, but not to fight over. So in particular, it seems that common to all the variants that you are considering are some propositions. One is that the creators of what sadly have come increasingly known as entertainment products deserve to be compensated, either as a matter of justice or as a matter of incentives or something. But you don't, not everybody in the room, for example, Yochai, would agree with this with respect to all forms of cultural output like music. But I think you and I were on the same page in this regard. Some form of compensation, some form of monetary support is important. And a second point of, I think, agreement is that retail payments for individual copies of cultural products, which is the mode that I grew up on. You go into a record store, you buy an album. That's no longer plausible as a mechanism for compensation and support. It's wildly inefficient, and it's impossible to enforce any longer. So for two independent reasons, we're just not going to do that anymore. So we have to find some other way of providing compensation. The difference between ex ante and ex post is actually, I think, less fundamental than it appears. So for example, in response to your question, don't you need some money up front to get some projects off the ground? Yes, surely you do. But the way this has worked for many decades in the movie industry is that all the money ultimately comes at the back end after the movie's produced. But there are intermediaries. Some of them are individuals, some of them are banks that loan the money to producers up front. And there are lots of those intermediaries scattered throughout the entertainment industry. So an environment in which you compensated people after the fact doesn't mean that there's no money available up front. It just means that there have to be organizations that provide the bridge. You mentioned the Blur Band proposal. Yes, I think that can be understood as ex ante compensation, meaning that you pay the bands to produce, or hope and expectation that you can produce. But the understanding of the Blur Banff drafters was that the decision about who to support was based in significant part on what they've done in the past. You don't say, well, I'm going to, or it would be only a minority of contributions that would go to people who have not yet produced music at all. It's rather you decide, you know, Radiohead, I like their last album, some money should go in their direction. So it's kind of ex post as well as ex ante. So these things, I think, are intertwined and appropriately intertwined. Now, so
the risk of opening up a question in early in your presentation.
It's not a risk. I mean, I don't want. The worst thing I could do is to start answering each question at a time. So please provide more thing, and then I will try to wrap up a bit by bringing some of my own ideas.
Well, I'm totally delighted the way this discussion unfolds. And I think Terry puts it beautifully in stating where the common ground is between the two of you and where the difference lies, as I've understood it. But my own stance is altogether different. It doesn't start from the assumption that the two of you share that we're necessarily in quest of some mechanism for making these payments. Not that I think that that's a bad thought, but my own instinct is much more of the order of the way you might think of architecting pathways in a new campus, where you spread the grass seed and then pave the parts that turn out to be. So I myself am much more of a frame that says, let's look and see who's making money in the free environment and support whatever that methodology is. That to me would be the right way to build in the new environment, rather than trying to structure a legal framework to accomplish something that we don't really quite know how best to do it.
You mind if I respond to that, Charlie? I have two case studies that I think might be interesting. One is an employee of mine. Her name's Jody, and she also has a website called economistsdoitwithmodels.com. And on this website, she posts video lectures of her teaching economic theory. She's also happens to be a student at this fine university. And as a result of this, she does many things, including consult for major textbook publishers who hire her on a regular basis to help them write their books. In a sense, like that model where she's not paid for her last idea, but her next one. And she actually makes quite good money doing this. The second example is another student at this university, at the law school, who's a good poker player and does the same thing with his poker techniques, posts videos online for people to see, and has become quite popular on a given website, and now is afforded the luxury of earning $700 an hour doing one-on-one poker lessons to help people for their individual problems. I'd purport maybe that the reputation gained from sharing valuable knowledge is a good lead generator for your services, which, no matter how hard we try, can never be digitized.
Well, unfortunately, time flows quicker than I would like it to, and so I like, let's say, to say just two things on why I think we need both rewards and ex ante support. Leaving aside Charlie's very acute description of what might be the blind spot in that, in the sense whether we really need to put in place a new financing schemes. I think we absolutely need rewards, because cultural goods and even expression in the public sphere are goods of experience. I mean, because that you know what each of us knows what they are to which degree they are good for us or they are enlightening or by experiencing them. And so installing only an ex ante thing, even taking in account the fact that people have done already good things before, would really, in my opinion, run a risk of not leading to a reinforcement of the existing in culture and public expression rather than to a discovery of new interesting things. And as I will move, you will see also that the impact on diversity could be quite problematic. Simply because if you are asking people to make decision about whom to support, you have much less fluidity than if you simply take the fluid use of works and accumulate data about what it is to reward people. As you can see, I will never use the word compensation, but I mean, I can afford it because I'm not a professor of intellectual property law, so I, reward was a word even more present in Terry's 2004 book, and I think really we need them. For why we need ex ante support, I would like to point to the fact that voluntary resource pooling to make possible the existence of works that weave the only the existing intermediaries and investment schemes would not exist. This is one of the real innovation that has appeared on the net for financing works. I mean, the success of Kickstarter, of participative co-production shows that not only is there a need from the viewpoint of people who have projects, but there is also a willingness and an understanding of that need by many people, contributors. The big uncertainty is how much that can scale up. It's really an open question. So that's all I have to say. I don't think we will conclude any of the three questions today. I mean, it's more to keep them in your mind. Now I like to move to another question that will also illustrate. How does that work?
Before you go there, can I?
Yeah, sure.
I was interested at the beginning of your talk. You said let's abandon the idea that it's important to establish a rights-based approach to people's ability to access, you know, cultural works. Because I think that's much more, that decision point is much more important than the ex post or ex ante. So if you continue with the rights-based approach and assume that people have right to access to knowledge and to cultural products regardless of their economic status, then you immediately end up in a position where any attempt to distribute the works and compensate based on turning them into a commodity form becomes a problem. So if you want anyone, regardless of economic circumstance, to be able to access any cultural work, then that requires you to create another type of mechanism, like a collective licensing mechanism, where you end up saying, well, let's take this money from, say, the service providers who are already, you know, is their profit margin large enough could we reduce it by enough, which would create a pool which could then be used either through intermediaries or through direct compensation to the cultural workers, enable the production that you're interested in to continue. But if you start by abandoning the right to access knowledge for all human beings, then you'll end up with what in my mind are sort of arguments that are actually external to the core of the problem of how do we amplify the open flows of the cultural goods that you just referenced at the end there.
Yeah, I share your view. I mean, it's except the difference is there were affirmations that copyright was unenforceable in the digital sphere, and that would be the reason for moving away from it for every type of activity. While my
I work more on the basis of a stronger disjunction between non-market activities and commercial activities, and I think some forms of copyright enforcement are possible for commercial use in the digital sphere, and actually they work every day badly, like most things human construct socially, but they work. What I really would like to stress, because is how many people do we have in mind here? These curves, you have seen hundreds of them, they are everywhere, they are presented as straight lines in the log space in dozens of books. There are curves that try to express what is the diversity of attention or access or sales of works or access to book in a library or whatever. And I want to urge you to consider the fact that there is a huge accepted wisdom that is simply wrong, totally wrong. It's called you can express it as the 80-20 principle from the Pareto law. You can express it as the zip flow with parameter one. It's the same hypothesis, and it's simply wrong. That is, when you look at, I've spent the past 6 years doing lots of empirical quantitative studies on forms of access to voluntary share works, public domain works, sales of works on carriers, peer-to-peer sharing, sales of downloads in things like iTunes. Some of these studies are very fragile because the commercial data is so sensitive that you get only partial access to it. So you have to. If you look at all that, you can see that you have huge differences in diversity of access, that is, in how much the attention is concentrated on few works or not. And if you express them with the zip flow, I mean, we are in Harvard, and George Zipf was a Harvard linguist, and he studied the frequency of words in texts, and he formulated a law about how it's distributed. His law has become the standard tool to study popularity distribution, and you can find in real life situation Zipf's law with a parameter of 0.5 and Zipf's law with a parameter that is basically information communities of a few thousand or 10,000 works, or laws with for sales of records by the majors with a Zipf law with a parameter of 1.4. So what does that mean concretely? Here, I have taken a fictitious country, the size of France, with about 2 million people who produce works. And the question I am asking is, how many of them share 90% of the attention? The line at the top, the horizontal line, is 90% of the attention. And if you look at the distribution of royalties from copyrights, which in France we have some ways to study because we have collecting societies and we have social rights for the people who obtain rights from them, you will find a figure which is in the order of 100,000 people receive any money from these collecting societies and in our copyright system, and only 9,000 receive enough to pay money for their pensions on this income. This concentration of the existing copyright system is also about what
Garland and Page, two writers who studied the diversity of attention for PRS for Music and Big Champagne, a journal of music, have found in single downloads, commercial single downloads. Probably it was iTunes they studied, but they did not mention it. Now, when I started thinking of that, I said, okay, imagine that everything becomes shareable. But there are rewards for it. So it means that also the big entertainment players, they will consider this is a source of income. So they will try to promote their stuff in sharing instead of focusing on polluting sharing networks. And so we are not quite sure we will get the present day diversity of sharing, which is much higher than the diversity of copyright. So these here are examples that are zip slow with parameters 1.1, 1.0, 0.9, and 0.8. So it's a much narrower range than the range we observe today. But you can see that the number of people who would share 90% of attention moves from 100,000 to 1.2 million. And this raises lots of questions about how many are truly all these people there? That is, would they come up for rewards? Because I'm thinking of rewards that can help anyone to take lessons to play a music instrument or to take courses to do better photographs. I mean, I'm not speaking of rewards to be a professional artist. I don't remember how I was supposed to word the question for this round, but basically what I would like your viewpoint is, what do you think will happen? Because we hear many people saying, you know, if sharing is legalized, it will be as concentrated than the existing distribution modes. And we hear other people saying, no, that's not true. By the way, there are huge differences between forms of sharing. For example, Emule, diversity in Emule and DC++ for the specialists are considerably more diverse than BitTorrent. BitTorrent has built-in properties but lead to one given level of diversity. And it's not high diversity. So basically, what do you think? Do you think a word of free sharing would be a word of diversity of access or not?
What do you mean by diversity when you use that word?
Let's say diversity of the types of cultural products that are available, or...
No. I mean clearly diversity of access. That is diversity of titles. I think, it seems that without us doing anything, the internet is providing for that. And if you look at, peer-to-peer networks, just when they were still used for music in 2008. They were no longer used very much for film, but they were used for music still. And at the time, there were maybe three times more different titles available than on iTunes or on all download platforms together. And in particular, an enormous amount of orphan works. So I think for titles, the jury has concluded, in my opinion. But for diversity of attention, how much, this is really an open question.
Can I push back on the fact that you're asking the question as opposed to saying a little bit more about the sources of your claim? I mean, you're making a claim that's a very strong one, empirically and empirically based, against a set of assumptions that everybody plays. Described yourself. And unless people have specific data to predict that, it'd be really interesting. So, for example, you said something very specific. Diversity of attention in Emule is lower, is higher, or rather the than in BitTorrent, and there are characteristics. If you can go for a couple of minutes more into what are the sources of data and why you see BitTorrent as replicating a degree of concentration of attention closer to the traditional copyright system, an EMU less, I think it would be very informative.
Let's say in contrast to some existing claims, including from around here, I have worked only with data that have been made entirely public for the claims on sharing. Because if you would put the same condition on the claims on commercial sales, you would not say anything because they have never made, and they will never, unless they are forced, make public the full distribution. But for so there was a big survey of Edonkey servers implementing the EMUL protocol at the time, done by Mathieu Latapy and his collaborators in University Paris 6. It was a study over 10 weeks. It's called 10 weeks in the life of an Edonkey server. The data is entirely public. There are 10 terabytes of it, so it's not that easy to process it. But it has 90 million users and 275 million file leads. And I mean, it's real stuff, and it's the only source of very large-scale data. Then there was another study conducted by Bodo Balash about film sharing in Hungary, where he did something very different, because he studied all the trackers, the closed and the open ones, and he crowdsources the connection between the file leads and the real film id in the movie database. So it's and so my claim about BitTorrent comes from that situation, which is must be compared with, but also from the Page and Garland article in published by PRS and For Music and Big Champagne, where their main aim at the time was to prove that the long tail in peer-to-peer sharing was there, but was not possible to exploit commercially. That is really what they, because it was too low levels of use. So they have studied the long tail in an unstated peer-to-peer network, but which I believe to be BitTorrent, and it corresponds about to a sort of a 1 point something Z flow. And but the reason why BitTorrent has this equivalent is a reason that a tracker will favor a 1-to-1 ratio between downloading and uploading, and mechanically it discourages putting online large collections of stuff, because some of them will not be accessed in this system due to the tracker policy, and as a result, you will be let's say your karma for the tracker will go down, and so I think there is nothing mysterious, and it has nothing to do with copyright. But the reason why BitTorrent is a wonderful protocol is to provide extremely quick scale reaction to the demand for something, and you cannot ask a protocol to do that well. That is, to scale up when suddenly 100,000 people want something, and to be at the same time diversity prone. I mean, I stop there.
I just wanted to say that I'm by no means as knowledgeable about this as many other people in this room, but one area that I would love to apply the lens that you're talking about is to free and open source software in terms of its ease of replication, but difficulty to necessarily contribute. And I don't know any specific numbers, I'm sure many other people here do, but that there is a certain concentration around a number of projects, and while many others languish, as you suggested before. So I'm just, I guess, more of a question to the crowd. Does anybody know anything about contributions to
what I can tell you is you can easily, I mean, on the 15th of November, we do a website with our algorithms running, and you can upload data sets. And you have example of data sets that are easily accessible, for example, Drupal modules, where you have in permanence the full publication of any Drupal module reports its use to the central module server, and which is a wonderful thing because you have really, you do not have only downloads, you know really how many of these modules are used. And so I mean, please do it. Take the table and upload it. And but of course, a functional tool like software, the properties of diversity cannot be analyzed. I'm not sure if I am clear when I say that, but a functional tool is something that with strong network effects. I mean, much stronger than just a cultural good. I mean, it's so maybe we find still lots of concentration in software. Sorry.
I mean, I know the answer to the question empirically, at least from
facts. Facts. Don't confuse us with the facts.
So, in free software projects, so if you look at data from SourceForge, for example, and the data is similar from Google Code, that only about 10% of projects have been downloaded 100 times. So only 10% of projects have been downloaded more than 100 times. So the 90th percentile is so about 100 times.
But that still doesn't tell you what is the diversity of attention. Because the fact that there is a very, very long tail of very little downloaded projects, this does not provide. What is important is really the rest of the curve.
You want the parameter of the
curve. This is a simplification. I have also proven that statistically the distribution of attention does not follow a zip flow. Already in a 2006 paper, but they are most real-life distribution are so close that to reflect on policy, this is an excellent tool. They are. But if you take a statistical test, it will tell you no, this is not obeying the Z-flow.
I mean, other kinds of like exponential curves like this that often fit better than zip curves. I've looked at comments and recommendations and comment threads and things like that. So I found places where zip is not the best curve, but I'm not totally clear on what you're saying that means in the context of this particular set of questions and topics. I mean, the fact that one exponential curve fits better than another doesn't mean a lot to me in the context of these different kinds of attention settings.
But I heard really some caution there, because for ages people considered the Pareto law and Zipf
to be completely
different when they are actually the same law. With a change of coordinates. So it's. But I think here the important thing, let's not. Linger on an extremely small detail. I mean, if you look at what I think is the diversity of attention on Emule for Music, it means that you have, if you look at the works between 4% and 34%, the next 30% after the hits, in one case in Emule sharing, they will get 90% of attention. In another situation, like they will get 80% and 20%. In one case, they will get 80%. In another case, they will get only 20% of attention. And let's say some commentators, they have defined these titles after the hits as, let's say, what they call the reservoir of cultural diversity. That is, things that have been appreciated by enough people so you know they are not total crap, but they have not reached a wide audience yet. So, more. Terry?
I'm find much of this fascinating, and I have a stake in their general conclusions, meaning that I argued for some of the scheme we discussed earlier, in part because of their potential to generate much greater diversity on this front, which for a variety of reasons I think is a wonderful idea. Having said all that, it strikes me that the data is slippery here, and particularly with respect to music, although to different degrees it can affect other media. One of the reasons it's slippery is that there is this well-known gap between downloading and listening. So you move smoothly between downloading data or downloading and uploading data and diversity of attention. But as we all know from our personal experience in the music context, the amount of time you spend listening to a given work is only loosely connected to the concentration of downloading. And there's old AT&T data on this front suggesting that it's ballpark less than half of the stuff downloaded through sharing systems get listened to one time. Now, with respect to movies, it's going to be a little bit different because the burden on downloading is much higher, and the likelihood you're going to listen and watch a given movie 100 times is much lower. Photography actually might be one where the measures are especially close together because you can see the full work before you decide to download. But there is, you would, if you really want to pursue, as I would love to see pursued, a hypothesis of enrichment of cultural experience on the part of the user, as well as enrichment of the set of people producing, it seems you would have to do something other than study the networks. You'd have to study the behavior of the people at the edges of the network. No?
I have read the chapter 6 of From Excuses to Keep so often that I am I remember the whole discussion and where you said download is not a proxy for enjoyment. My own viewpoint is if you have a public sphere of sharing that is legal, you can collect what I call clues. I think we must be very modest about, I think actually whether people enjoyed something, I would like to keep that outside of the reward system. But I would like real clues that they had an anticipation in the case of download, or an appreciation in the case, for example, of linking, embedding in a blog post, etc. So what I've proposed in my book is to collect as many of these various clues as possible, provided they don't need to intrude in user privacy. And actually, my proposal is for collecting data on the user machine, but for the user to belonging to a voluntary sample, like in your proposal, to submit it after reviewing it to eliminate whatever they don't want to submit. So I think there's no, let's say I agree that, of course, there is a difference. I have not been able to compare the situation of downloads and on personal listening, but I have been able to compare streaming and downloads on platforms that offer both of voluntary shared music, and there is a bit less in that case diversity in downloads, because people start by sharing and then downloads only what they like. In that case, it was in that direction. But I mean, this is an open question. I mean, actually, I consider myself and if you read the book, you will see I am saying it, that the data is very fragile. But at least, I mean, I will be putting online all the software to use and all the data sets and everything, and people can try to do better.
Have you or anyone looked at YouTube
plays as an indicator of this, the actual listening. I mean, there's this, you know, emergent cultural norm. I mean, it's limited in terms of people who have broadband connections in the home mostly, but it's still an interesting potential data set, which is that people don't even bother to download stuff from file sharing networks. People just create playlists on YouTube videos, regardless of what the video is. It might just be a still image of the album cover or whatever, and you just play it. And that's a very common and widespread practice among young, at least young people here. I don't know how it translates, transnationally, but there you've got the actual, play counts. So that would be a kind of interesting.
I must say I have a conflict of interest here, in the sense that I'm an advocate of very strong importance of possession for enabling a number of activities. So I'm quite critic of schemes that are focusing on just providing access when you want it. Like it's already CASA was used, as you described, for music, as a kind of jukebox, and people didn't bother. I mean, even if they actually had a file on their computer, they didn't bother with that. I mean, if you look at how they were using the stuff, they just wanted to be able to listen whenever they wanted. And
claim about it being good. It's just a question of it's an interesting data set to get at this set of problems that you're addressing, which is you don't really know what people are listening to. But in that particular case, which is a widespread cultural practice, you do know. Because you've got the
play class. But I'm not sure listening should be the only... for example, Clay Shirky made claims about diversity of attention on the full internet based on links. But links have been proven to be a very biased indicator in comparison to access. But in the other direction, I think if someone recommends something, this is a stronger statement than listening to it. So I think it's really complex. I mean, I believe anyway, if it is not done in a legally instituted system, it will be done by communities who want to organize the distribution of money amongst themselves, and they will have values about what is important, and probably diversion values. I'm sorry because we're late, but we go back to that now, but I just want to tell you what was the third point that we won't have the time to discuss. It was a discussion on reward functions. Because, there is an ongoing debate on whether reward should be proportional, below proportional, or topped off, as in some Swedish laws, for access or use on the internet. I believe it's a very interesting issue of distributive justice, and there are many reasons for which you cannot do what you want. You infuriate people if you don't give them, give big money to the big earners of today, but also because if you start having two below proportional laws, you run into many problems. So that was my...
I actually want to push you to say a little bit more. We said we would go to between 1:30 and 1:45, so we are constrained. We have already on the table that you think the order of creators will be in the low millions in a nation like France rather than the...
my typical figures are something like a little above 1 million in a country like France,
something like
4.2 million in a country like the US.
But that's what I'm saying, low millions in these kinds of large economies, that you want some synthesis between ex ante funding and some form of a reward function. You've identified that you want to find all sorts of data sets that will allow us to predict more or less what people are using, and that's part of the conversation. And then that, I think we should try not to leave the room without knowing what the proposal is, and I think that'll come out of the question of the rewards. So maybe just a few more minutes and really to focus on that.
Well, the proposal is yet another of the 15 schemes that have been debated for the last 10 years. with some, I should say the proposal is not just my proposal. I mean, I worked out the details, but it is the proposal of a platform called Creation Public Internet that brings together a musician union, a group of movie figures, the main consumer union in France, and our group, La Quadrature du Net. And the strong point in the proposal are all media included. When Terry wrote Promises to Keep, he said maybe one day the books will be included, but it's too early to do it. Now I say, I mean, I agreed, but now I say it's going to be too late if we don't include them now, because they are experiencing the disaster of an industry that fails to adapt to the digital sphere. And so all media included, but including internet native media. But there you run into a problem. I mean, if you go from the 100 people to the 1,200,000 people, you run into measurement problems that are much harder than what Terry in 2004 and myself in 2008, we not only considered but sort of proved to be feasible objectives. Building a measurement system that is precise enough, not aiming at absolute justice, which I think Aristotle told us it was a recipe for disaster. Let's say not too bad justice, which would be much better than today's injustice. And so that's all media, including internet native. Right now I am, depending on countries, around 60% rewards based on what I call use clues or appreciation clues, and 40% ex-ante support using the competitive intermediary model, which means they are entirely decided by each individual. But with a difficulty that you have to do it at least once a year, and it's it takes time because you will have a very long list of people who are habilitated to receive this type of support. And I also had something for the environment of creation, what I call the orphan editorial functions. I think this is a major challenge. Sustaining the added value function of an editorial team in a book publisher, or sustaining the what was the producer role in a phonographic firm at the time where that producer would sit in the recording sessions and give advice for the full duration of the, which is something that no longer exists in big big industry, but still exists in small labels. These things are immensely important. Maybe they are the, and so that's about it. Measurement is based on a voluntary sample of users, not representative, don't care. Let's say I suggest that it doesn't matter if a sample is biased. I mean, it's very offensive because it's reward to the rewarders. I mean, they get more. If you participate in the process, you have more influence than if you do not participate. But it's this is all of this I expect to be completely different if it materializes. But that's what my initial position. I don't know if that was clear, this last point. And because you do not get there is a trade-off between precision and a resistance to fraud. Basically, the way I model it is I estimate how much is the monetary value of injecting a fake use clue in the system. And if that figure becomes too high, then it's clear that organized fraud, I mean, the notion of a creator organizing fraud for himself, etc., we all know from social system that this is not the issue. But the issue is organized fraud. I mean, people who build complex system to fraud the. So that's it.
To me, it seems that the challenge as we get a growing population is managing that distinction between signal and noise, or art and content, or knowledge and information. It seems to me that's what you're saying, to which I guess I would ask a question to everyone. Shouldn't we all be asking ourselves, what am I doing to create and curate knowledge for the rest of the world? To the extent that, you know, projects like Wikipedia and MIT OpenCourseWare and individuals like Salman Khan share their cognitive surplus, isn't it then our almost moral obligation to do what we can to add our own value to that system of common knowledge?
Yeah, I don't, I mean, you know, there was recently a Rethink Music conference here with the Berklee College of Music. I mean, I think the global feeling was that statutory payments in the U.S. were absolute non-flyers. I say, well, too bad for the U.S. Because I do believe that that's why, for example, I don't want the ISPs to pay the money on their profits, not because I like the ISPs. I'm not suspect of that, but it's because I want the individuals to be empowered to say, this is my money, how do you govern it? And I know it is, let's say, it's the kind of optimism an aging person can have, because you say, well, we will see if it can be done.
So just one thing that I wanted to throw into the mix is, I think it's important to ask the questions, how works acquire authority, and maybe even more specifically, from whom? I wrote a little bit about this myself and sort of reached back in history, and, you know, there was a time when a patron assigned authority to a work solely on the strength of his social status, and things I think probably improved in the current system, where we have, at least we can say that if money is flowing efficiently toward a product or capital toward a product, then it must have some kind of merit to it. But even better now, where you know, the means of reproduction has sort of landed in all of our laps. The struggle, I think, is how do we? I still think that there's vestiges of that old apparatus that, you solely by virtue of having a printing press, you could assign authority to a work and make it more consequential than a work that isn't published. We still have vestiges of that now. We still have publishing houses that. So, you know, I can sell my book on the Kindle, but I'm competing with books that are on the shelf at Barnes & Noble. I'm not sure how you overcome that problem, whereby people are making a lot of ex ante and not necessarily merit-based, although I'm sure they're efficient with their market projections and everything else. I'm not sure how you overcome the inequities in... and how works acquire authority. I think we're looking at a more democratic system now, but building authority from the ground up, I mean, you were describing a couple of cases where that happens, but it's very hard to do.
Mm-hmm. I will try to say.
So, I mean, this is not completely disconnected. There's been a conversation in the back channel about questions of sort of how this, I mean, a related idea of how the attention is distributed, about how it changes. I mean, you sort of, and because questions of the distribution of attention is sort of important to this conversation, I think that
I don't know, the takeaway that we were talking about some of the work of Matt Salganik. I don't know if you know, he's a sociologist at Princeton who looks at popularity and sort of faddishness, and has found that actually very small design changes in terms of conveying more information about what other people are doing can have enormous effects on the distribution and on the predictability, in the sense that the stuff that's at the top when social effects become more visible. And so when you're designing a technical system or a social system, that you can't take the distribution of attention for granted, and then in fact you can shape it towards particular types of distribution that may or may not fit, I don't know, the type of society you want. So that's just sort of pushing the conversation out a little bit further. And I think that's related to questions of how authority is created as well.
I agree it's related. My view here is not that if there is anything natural about it, about the distribution, but it is that there is a diversity of players who are trying to shape it. And so the question about a social system is, does it empowers more this or this type of players to do it? It's not that we have a natural system and we then should turn it into natural rewards. It's that if people are allowed to become distributors of culture in the non-market sphere, and they can build their own tools, and they can invest in new community management software, and they can develop. The roles of DC++ are entirely different. I mean, they value people who provide very large collections. This is the type of design decisions that has a strong impact on diversity. But the rules of design of how you do give access to work on a site are, you know, in most cases you have the most downloaded or whatever, the most, and then because people see how bad that is in terms of reinforcing the existing concentration, they put random choices, or, and I mean, they try to compensate, and this is what I expect. Is if we can explore a wide sphere of free digital exchange, then we will have innovation. But we will also have people who try to construct the attention. Instead of fakes, I'm sure the majors will inject recommendations and stuff like that, and they will have the means to do it. I mean, for example,
They already do that.
And they do the same, both at the same time, polluting and recommending.
There's a lot of excitement, and I hope people can come and keep the conversation. But this has been really fantastic and fascinating, and thank you very, very much. Thank you.